This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, you might say with more than 25 Jack Reacher novels out there, plus a couple of Tom Cruise movies, that maybe we don't need a Jack Reacher TV series. But who can ever get enough of Jack Reacher, that former military cop who roams from town to town like some crew-cut samurai, setting things right with his unerring and incredibly violent code of morality? The 8-episode series Reacher just premiered on Amazon.
Well, a smart move would be to shoot me right here, but you haven't done that yet. Maybe you don't want to draw attention firing outside a crowded bar. Or maybe you have orders to take me to your boss so we can find out how much I know. Whatever it is, it means that when I make my move, you're going to hesitate. And you guys know what Cato said about hesitation, right? He who hesitates...
This all-American tough guy is the creation of Englishman Lee Child, who was born James Grant. He graduated law school before beginning a career in television, all before his immensely successful run writing action thrillers. I had a chance to talk with Lee Child back in the summer of 2018. It was just before the Jack Reacher novel Past Tense had come out. Lee Child, is an absolute delight to have you here. You've made so many summers come alive for me reading you. I never read on the beach. I don't know why people do that, but at least I go outside and I read a Lee Child novel. I'm a happy, happy boy.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Thank you.
Well, so I'm full of questions, and naturally I want to ask you about the way this all began. You were working as an executive in 1995, and you got fired and decided, to hell with it, I'm going to work for myself and become a superstar writer of thrillers.
Well, it wasn't quite that linear. I was a television director and very happy where I was. It was in Britain, during what in retrospect looks like a golden age of drama is well remembered. I mean, my company did Jewel in the Crown, Brideshead Revisited, Prime Suspect, just some really terrific shows. But it was also a fabulous news station, documentary station. It was really the height of the height. And then broadcasting in Britain, like I think everywhere in the world, got shook up, particularly by Rupert Murdoch's influence, and the whole thing started to fall apart.
You lost your job because of Rupert Murdoch?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Rupert Murdoch wanted to bring his satellite service to Britain, and in order to do that, he needed to attack and weaken the terrestrial services, the BBC and the independent broadcasters. And it was a pretty transparent deal with the Thatcher government. You know, you let me do this, help me out a little bit, and I will support you in my papers and on the air.
Why did you, and you were named Jim Grant still then,
uh-huh,
why did you get fired?
Because I was 39 years old, an expensive veteran with a big salary and benefits, a pension, and all that kind of thing. And they discovered that they could get recent graduates to do the work for a quarter of the price.
So now, what made you believe that you could walk out the door sit down, change your name, and become a great writer of thrillers?
Well, I didn't necessarily believe it. I just thought that at that age, at that stage of your life, this is probably the last chance to try something new, to make a big break. I did not want to leave the world of entertainment. I'm just totally in love with that idea. I mean, you very kindly mentioned you sit outside in a chair and read my book and enjoy it. And I just absolutely love that transaction, that I can do something that somebody else is going to enjoy. And television satisfied that for a long time. But when I left television, I wanted to stay in that world, basically. So the question was, how can I stay? What can I do that will supply me with the same feeling?
So you did a particular thing, not just one, a series of particularities. First of all, you invented Jack Reacher and stuck with him. He's an American. You're not. He's a complete loner. Malcolm Gladwell and others have compared him to a kind of cowboy. It's like the form of a Western, a man who wanders into a town, in his case, hitchhikes in. No change of clothes. His only possession is a toothbrush. He senses trouble and complications begin.
Yeah.
Former military policeman. So how did you invent him? Why is he an American?
Well, it was a whole batch of reasons that happily all pointed in the same direction. First of all, you know, really the hardest thing about being a writer, or I suppose an artist of any kind, is that you have to believe several different things, some of which are contradictory, but you have to believe them all 100%, completely wholeheartedly. And of course, I believe that this is an art, it's a craft, it's a joy, it's creative, all that good stuff. But it's also a job, it's a business. And so I had a vague eye on the business side of it, which was that so many other people, in fact, everybody else that was writing a series was writing essentially a soap opera with a fixed location. It would either be location-based or employment-based or both. And the hero would have probably colleagues and a superior he didn't like and subordinates that were difficult. He would have possibly a partner, an apartment, a favorite bar, a favorite restaurant, neighbors, the whole thing. The classic soap opera, which I'm in no way denigrating. I worked in television. I made my living on soap operas for nearly two decades. They're incredibly powerful and actually quite sophisticated form of narrative. But everybody was doing it. So I thought, well, let's not do that. Let's do the anti-soap opera.
Strip it down.
Yeah, where there's only one character. There's no repertory cast surrounding him. There's one character. There's no location. He can be anywhere. He has no job, so he can do anything. So it was really a study in loneliness, alienation in a way. And that had to be in America because Malcolm Gladwell talks about cowboys. Well, yeah, that's fine, but where did cowboys come from? The cowboy myth is essentially a development of a medieval myth from Europe, the knight errant.
Knight, yeah.
The knight who has somehow transgressed against the court and has been banished, sentenced to wander the land and do good deeds. Same thing in Japan, Japanese culture, the ronin, exactly the same thing, a samurai who's been disowned by his master and sentenced to wander the land doing good deeds. So it's really that tradition, and you can't do that in Britain. Britain is too small. It is too densely populated. There are no empty areas. There's no mystery about it. America has the frontier feel.
Wandering into the Cotswolds wouldn't work in the same way as Nebraska.
It totally wouldn't, because everybody in the Cotswolds knows your business immediately and everybody knows everything. There's no possibility of hidden secrets. It has to be the wide open spaces.
Now, I can't believe you write the way you've described this. You sit down every year at September 1st. You don't sit down with an outline. Don't do research, even though some of your novels seem to indicate, a knowledge of opioids or a knowledge of this of place. And then you just start and off you go. That's a very strange way to write any kind of novel, much less
it
what
is.
I would have thought a Jack Reacher novel would be pretty heavily plotted and you'd have charts on the wall.
Absolutely not. Nothing on the wall. And you know, it's summertime now and acutely aware that September the 1st is approaching. And I'm thinking, I have zero idea.
How do you feel about that? Is it impending doom or
pleasure?
Yeah,
I mean, half my mind is impending doom. You know, the gas tank is empty. Finally, I've been found out. Finally, it's all going to fall apart. And then I think, well, wait a minute, you felt like that for the last 20 books. And so you've managed them before, you can manage this one. And for me, it's about always about the story. And I want the story to be organic, naturally unfolding. And I feel that if I wrote an outline, it would be a rather artificial structure. I'd be forcing the story into an artificial route that it probably didn't want to take. So I just start in the beginning and I hope to get a good first sentence or a good first paragraph. And then I think, all right, now what happens? What happens now?
Do you ever go 75 pages in and it's a bust and you have to
never,
start again?
Never.
How is that possible?
Because, well, two reasons. First of all, that would be very inefficient. It would drive me mad to do that. And I can usually tell before about 7 words if I'm heading down a bad track. I can tell pretty early. And so I sometimes delete 7 words, but that hurts quite a lot, I'll tell you. But it's really about one thing leads from another in a very organic way. For instance, the new book, Past Tense, I wrote the first sentence and the first paragraph anyway, and there were 2 things in it. One I had mentioned Maine. Reacher has to start from somewhere. So he's in Maine for the summer. Now he's planning to head south for the winter.
And he gets to New Hampshire.
Right. He only gets as far as New Hampshire, but he's planning to go all the way south to Southern California. Like the birds migrate. And I have a pretty mellifluous sentence there in the beginning about the migration of birds, some typical species. And I just wrote that thinking, okay, this is a good place to start. And then immediately, first of all, the bird watching. Well, years ago in one of the books, it was mentioned that Reacher's father was a bird watcher, because I wanted the contrast between a pretty vicious marine soldier and his hobby, which was bird watching. I found that an interesting contrast. So in the back of my mind, okay, why have I started this with a reference to birds? Maybe this book ought to be about Reacher's father. You know, I start on September 1st because that's the anniversary of when I started the very first book. So it's a sentimental day to start. I start on the 1st of September and work every available day until the book is finished, which is usually around the next March because a lot of other things get in the way.
Oh, you do leave your desk. You'll leave town.
I've got family stuff. They want to do Christmas and all those kind of things.
It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, they drag you away.
Now, this is one of the most amazing things. At a certain point, I think you were writing Make Me. An English academic named Andy Martin sat there with you in your study and watched you write a novel.
Yeah, he was
30 cups of coffee a day, like Balzac.
Yeah, possibly more. I think my record is mid-30s. Mugs of coffee, not just little cups. You know, let's get serious about this.
That's impressive. You have an impressive stomach.
Yeah, Andy was It happened very short notice. He's a rather freewheeling academic from Cambridge University, and literally days before I started that novel, he came up with that idea. And probably if I'd had longer to think about it, I would have said no. But because time was short, it was my 20th book, I just thought, let's do something different. And to a certain extent, I wanted to have it on record, not for me personally necessarily, but for all of us in this genre, because there is a lot of cheap talk about how it's somehow easy to write these books, that there are various terms used, crank them out and so on, which is actually very much the opposite of the truth.
But even the way you describe it, it sounds easy. You sit down on September 1st, you don't write a second or third or 50th draft. No outline. So what is the difficulty? Describe that.
Well, really the difficulty is with a readership the size of a successful genre writer's readership.
And what is this? Kill me. Go ahead and kill me. What is the scale of your readership?
Well, millions of people, you know, globally around the world, a Reacher book sells every 9 seconds. So there's a lot of people reading them. And you cannot look at that as a monolithic mass, because with an audience that size, they're very striated. They're very different. At the center, you've got the expert readers who just read all the time, like Malcolm Gladwell. You know, mine is not the only book that he reads that week, obviously. He reads constantly. So do a lot of people, and they have to be satisfied. Mm. But on the very far edges of the audience are the people that read one book a year on their vacation, on the beach. That's all they will read. And you've got to satisfy both those readers and everybody in between.
And you feel them out there. You feel that immense audience.
Yeah, because you meet them. You meet the extremely unlikely people that are fans. And then you meet people who are clearly the one book a year person. And touchingly, their biggest compliment that they can pay you is they will say, "I loved your book. I finished it," which is a huge achievement. They feel that it's their achievement.
It's an unusual act.
Yeah, they finished a book. They're very satisfied. They're happy with themselves. And, of course, they're happy with the book because the book has aided them to do that. And how do you do that? The real skill, and I think the skill that Andy Martin observed day to day, is the rhythms of the book. The book has got to be a locomotive that drives people through without being noticeably such.
Finally, will Jack Reacher ever leave us or leave you?
I'm fascinated with the whole showbiz thing of leave them wanting more. Don't be the embarrassing guy that sticks around two seasons too long. We see that all the time in shows on television. We see it with athletes. You've got to pick your time to go. And I do not want Reacher to become an embarrassing old character that's bought kind of out of habit or sentimentality.
So you might leave him behind and write about someone or something else?
No, I would leave him behind and retire completely. Do not forget, I'm from Europe. I have no work ethic. Retirement is a phase of life that I'm keenly looking forward to.
Are you?
Yeah.
What would you do on September 1st?
Read. That's the only thing I resent about writing is the time it takes away from reading. That I would... literally, I've got rooms full of books just stacking up, just waiting to be read.
What's the biggest masterpiece that's just sitting there staring at you and saying, "You have not read me"?
I've never read Jane Austen, which is shocking for an English person. But the Russians of the 19th century, maybe Flaubert, stuff like that. And then, of course, the fabulous thing about books is you don't know what the classics are. There's something sitting there in my living room right now that is could be the best read of my life. And I don't know what it is yet because I haven't tried it.
Well, Lee Child, I'm incredibly grateful to you, but don't leave Jack Reacher too soon, okay?
I honestly...
You can squeeze in Jane Austen somehow.
I could probably read her in the evenings after I finished writing Reacher, but that would be quite a contrast.
Lee Child, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I spoke with Lee Child in 2018. The most recent Jack Reacher novel is called Better Off Dead, and it was co-written with his brother, Andrew Child. The 8-episode series Reacher premiered on Amazon on Friday. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest.
Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, we're in a moment when issues of speech are leading headlines week after week. Battles over what people can or should be able to say on Spotify podcasts, Netflix specials, on social media, and in school classrooms around the country. Next week on the program, we're going to look at many sides of that complex issue. And one of the people I talk to is Cliff Nesteroff, who studies the history of comedy. Nesteroff argues that debates about representation, particularly of minority groups, are not new at all in our society.
It's interesting if you look at the 1930s, of course, blackface was still prevalent and black stereotypes were prevalent. If you read the black press, which you can now do thanks to the internet, go back through the archives of newspaper.com and read the New York Age or the Pittsburgh Courier or the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American or the California Eagle, the major black newspapers of the 1930s, you will see editorials and letters complaining about that shit all the time. Why are we being insulted? Why don't they stop with this hackneyed, tired, old stereotypes? We're beyond this. We're human beings. And nobody listened. So minorities and their concerns were very easily ignored in those days. I just came out with a new book recently, which is about indigenous representation or lack thereof. And I have an example in the book of a contingent of Native American leaders complaining about racist stereotypes in silent movies. The year 1911. Oh, you can't joke about anything anymore. In the year 1911. So that has gone on. Those grievances have been lodged for ages, but were willfully ignored as long as indigenous peoples or African Americans did not have the purchasing power or the influence in the body politic to have their voices heard.
More from Cliff Nesteroff and others on the struggle over speech next week. Now, to close the show this week, I wanted to check in with Graciela Machkovsky. Graciela writes for The New Yorker about politics and culture in Latino communities especially, and she directs a program in bilingual journalism at the City University of New York. Graciela has lived here for years, and she immigrated to the U.S. from Argentina in 2013. She told me that just recently, she started to reconnect to the music that she'd grown up with during the pandemic, when she was spending a lot more time with her family.
So, you know, it's me, my husband, and my son. He's now 10. So the first year of the pandemic in September, we heard that he was going to go back to school to in-person classes every other day. So we decided to get a car, a little Honda Fit, because we would go to the school. That was a 30-minute drive. So this actually led to the need for music and playlists.
Now, Graciela, you grew up in Argentina. Is music something that brings back home in some way? Is there a nostalgic element to you?
I'm not nostalgic. I never really miss home. I miss my parents. I miss people, but I don't miss the country. I was actually so sick of the country when we left. I just really, it was so frustrating. And so what happened when we started, my husband created the playlist, is that you know, he had a different relationship with the country. He grew up in exile. They were kicked out of the country during our last military dictatorship. So to him, going back to Argentina was always important. I grew up in a very small town in Patagonia and in the provinces, and I always wanted to escape. So one day we're driving and my husband plays this music by this great Argentine singer, Luis Alberto Spinetta. He was a huge figure, a legend in the history of Argentinian rock. We have a National Musicians Day, and it's this guy's birthday. I hated his music. I couldn't stand his voice. He has this very mellow voice, very lyrical. And when I was growing up, I didn't connect with his music. And so we're driving and my husband plays a song by Spinetta. And I'm like, oh, great. You know, the playlist thing created some tension in the cars.
As it always does. As it always does. Yeah. Now, what's the name of the song, Graciela?
So the name of the song is Cantata de Puentes Amarillos.
And how would you translate that?
A song of yellow bridges. It's a 9-minute, 12-second song. I think it's the longest song in Argentinian rock. And it was recorded in 1973. It's a song that connects very different surreal images that come from very different sources. Guarda el hilo, nena, guarden bien tus manos. So the song has this moment, which is where I actually converted to Alberto Spinetta on that ride. We stop at a red light and I hear him sing this wonderful line that I'll translate as, even if they force me, I will never say that the past was better, tomorrow is better. Aunque me fuercen, yo nunca voy a decir que todo el tiempo por pasado fue mejor. Mañana es mejor. And then at the end, he just sings tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. And this is September 2020. There was no vaccine yet. A song that really spoke to this moment, which was really unexpected because he didn't mean that. But, you know, that's what music does.
What would be your second pick on the playlist?
So as I mentioned, you know, I'm from the provinces. And in the provinces, there's this folk music. It's called samba, and it's samba with a Z. So it's not the Brazilian samba. And samba is this... it's a dancing music where a couple dances with white handkerchiefs and they round each other. I hated this music because it was the music it was the music of the provinces and this oppression. And being a woman growing up in the provinces, to me, it was really difficult. So that music represented my desire to just leave and never listen to that music again. And one of our major folk singers, she passed in 2009. Mercedes Sosa is her name. And she was this huge, huge singer. And she was world known. And, you know, she sang in Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center. She has a very characteristic voice, very deep, wonderful voice, with a very thick accent from the north of the country. I just couldn't hear that. It made me cringe. And so we... But my husband loves her. Everybody loves her except for me. So we're going to the Catskills one weekend and he plays Mercedes Sosa. I'm like, great, fantastic. And then I start listening to this song. It's called Samba para Olvidarte, which means samba, you know, this music to forget you. No sé para qué volviste. And it's about the end of a love, to forget the person she's loved. But it's very sad, and her voice is so deep, and she's like, there's nothing left of our love, and there's only this song, there's this song in my guitar. And then, like, for the first time, I'm moved by her voice. ¿Para qué volviste? And I just listen to this song now all the time, and it's become one of my favorite songs. I think it's just beautiful. Tarde se ha puesto triste y yo prefiero callar. ¿Para qué vamos a hablar de cosas que ya no existen? No sé. And finally, we're now getting pretty far south on the FDR Drive, close to your kid's school. And I have to remember my own kids when they were really young and I was foisting music on them. You know, it was a complicated battle. Sometimes they liked it. Little kids always seem to like the Beatles. And then the next thing you foist on them, that's the end, and they want their own stuff. What is the final song you're putting in front of your son in the car? And I wonder how he's reacting too. So he doesn't like any of this music, but this third song he really likes. So this is the one we play the most. Those are too sad for him, you know?
Yeah.
So the last one, it's called Loco, Tu Forma de Ser. Loco means crazy, and Tu Forma de Ser means your way of being or the way you are. This is a song from the 90s, and it's a song by Los Auténticos Decadentes, the Authentic Decadents, I guess you'll translate their name. And it's this big band of guys who do ska and reggae and combined with Latin American rhythms like cumbia, candombe, and rock.
What are they singing about, Graciela?
So the wonderful thing about this song is I cannot translate it to you, really, because it's in the vernacular, like a very kind of lowbrow Buenos Aires vernacular. So the first scene is this woman comes into the bar and she's with another guy and she trips and falls for some reason. That's never explained. But then she throws, if you translate it literally, she throws a penguin at him. And a pinguino, a penguin, is actually something only an Argentinian of my generation or older will know. But the penguin is a jar, a ceramic jar in the shape of a penguin that was very traditional to serve cheap Argentinian wine before we invented Argentinian Malbec. So it was like the cheap wine you buy in a gallon plastic. Here would be this jug wine.
Or wine in a box we now have.
Exactly, in a box. And you mixed it with seltzer because it was so bad. That's how my parents still drink wine. So I just feel this sense of exhilaration when I hear these words. And the song is full of these words that are very specific to a moment of Argentinian vernacular. And I do speak Spanish a lot in the city, but I speak Spanish now with Peruvians and Mexicans and Colombians and Caribbeans, you know. I speak Spanglish at home with my kid, but I don't speak Argentinian anymore. So that's what this song is to me. So it's just this joy of reconnecting with my language.
Let's hear it. Let's hear the Authentic Decadents playing Loco. Graciela, obviously for me, these three songs are new, and it's a great pleasure to hear your memories of them. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find Graciela Muchkowski's work for us at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Hope you enjoyed the show and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.